And finally, just a note on the close of session forecast. The close of session forecast, again, what goes on in May here is the most important for us. Our May forecast, once we lock that in, then we do one more adjustment. We wait until the legislature is done passing laws, and then we go ahead and fold the impacts of those laws as estimated by the Legislative Revenue Office. We fold those directly into our May forecast and use that to set the bar for the two-year budget and the kicker as well. And that, of course, is the next forecast, which hopefully will look a lot like this one. In particular, if the economic outlook is stable, which I believe it is, at this point in the business cycle, or in the biennium rather, in the budget cycle, it's really all about the April tax season and what folks are going to pay based on the liability that they built up in 2014. So a lot of it's already baked in the cake at this point going forward, but the economic outlook does have, you know, very, very big impacts on future biennia, as, you know, growth rates can compound over time. So in terms of the economic outlook, and like I said before, the data flow has been, you know, universally positive out there. More positive for Oregon than other places, as Oregon has clearly regained its traditional growth advantage during expansions. Our boom-bust nature, we grow faster during expansions, and we fall a lot farther during recessions, and that traditional growth advantage has certainly come back. The first picture up here are job growth rates, the red line being Oregon's job growth. This is a smoothed series. We correct the officially published series for to get some of the noise out of it to predict our future revisions of the series and the like. But, you know, given that, we really accelerated here in 2013 as our expansion got more broad-based across industries in the state and across regions of the state. As we picked up some of our secondary metropolitan areas started growing as well, we saw growth accelerate, and we've been sitting here at this almost 3% rate now for over a year, which is just about as fast as we grew during the peak of the housing boom. So this is pretty, you know, pretty good for Oregon. But nevertheless, out there, most people are becoming most economists or analysts who do this sort of forecasting are becoming more optimistic. And really, what's behind that is faster job growth at the U.S. level. The blue line you see here is the Wall Street Journal consensus forecast, which, as you see, always seems to tend to follow what's actually going on today, the current data flow. As there are more job growth today, analysts expect more to come there and tomorrow. But, of course, just because the U.S. is finally picking up, you know, does not necessarily mean that Oregon will as well. And in fact, it's kind of a hard case to make right now, and we're going to explain in some detail why that is going forward. But nevertheless, the growth advantage is there, and folks are becoming more optimistic, including our economic advisory group. Almost universally, we were getting advice to become more aggressive with our growth forecast going forward. But it's not easy for us to just take that advice offhand because, you know, this is a planning forecast, we have to be sure that we don't add a couple hundred million today and take a couple hundred million away 2 months from now and the trauma that causes. And so we have to, you know, have good reason, you know, what has changed over the last 3 months that would cause us to become more optimistic. And there is one big reason that's standing out right now, and I'll have Josh talk about it a little bit.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, Mr. Chairman, Josh Lander with the Office of Economic Analysis. As Mark said, the one big change we've seen in recent months is oil prices and energy prices more broadly. Of course, this has been an ongoing decline. Oil prices fell about 50% from early fall through, you know, last month or so. Over the last 6-8 months, they've fallen in half, and that's really acted equivalently like a large tax cut for the average household across the country. It's a big boost to consumer spending, or at least to consumer budgets, as they have to spend less at the pump, primarily. It's somewhere in a neighborhood of $750 per household across the U.S. We will spend less on gas this year than the previous year just due to lower oil prices and lower gasoline prices. When the fall in oil prices was occurring, you got some mixed commentary out there that, you know, this is also going to be a bad thing for the U.S. economy because we are now a large oil producer. And you can see in the map on the right, certain states do not benefit from lower oil prices. You think about, you know, the increases in drilling and fracking technology that we've had, certainly in the last decade in this country, in regions of the country like North Dakota and Texas, the Gulf Coast, Oklahoma, places like that where the fracking is most prominent, they are negatively impacted as businesses pull back on new investment in the area. There will be energy-related job losses in Texas, no question. But across the whole country, unequivocally, lower gas prices are a good thing for the economy as it will allow for more discretionary spending, more savings, things of that nature for the typical household. And overall, it will boost the economy somewhere in the neighborhood of about half a percentage points of GDP is what a lot of the estimates that are out there in as the energy prices go down for the typical household.
So as a result, we feel comfortable. You'll see we increased it. We didn't pick up Oregon growth rate, but we allowed it to continue at this high level for a little bit longer into the next biennium, largely because of this and a more robust recovery at the national level. But as I said before, I mean, that we don't need a robust recovery here because these are clearly the salad days for Oregon's economy. But Even so, there are problems. And the biggest problem people talk about is still slack in the labor market. And this is what the federal monetary policymakers, Chairwoman Yellen at the Fed, talks about in terms of monetary policy. When will we know that things are back close enough to operating at full capacity or on all cylinders to start raising rates and to change the nature of monetary policy? And what people point to are deeper measures of labor market performance. We've seen jobs come back, but we haven't seen everything else come back. In particular, there's really no wage growth at the U.S. level and very little labor force gains. And we still have problems with long-term unemployment and folks that are working part-time who would like to be working full-time and the like. So there are still slack inside the labor market. But as Oregon leads recovery, it appears that we're leading the way here, too, that we in Oregon we're starting to see very strong signs that this slack is getting pulled up. In particular, you see here, of course, the job growth has been going on for some time. That's the blue graph. The middle graph are wages, and that's turned around sharply. Those are real wages, inflation adjusted, and that's turned around very sharply over the last year and a half. And we're seeing really good wage gains, and this translates directly into withholding of in terms of our tax revenue. So this isn't a data quirk. This is certainly real. But not part of the narrative. The narrative out there for Oregon has been very much like the U.S. narrative, that we've been having jobs but no wage growth, and that's simply not true. We've been seeing some very healthy wage gains, although not for very long, you know, only a year or so. But what those wages do, once we start seeing jobs become easier to get, when workers become harder to find, because, you know, that's when wages start to get bid up by employers. Well, now that wages are getting bid up and job opportunities are a little bit more prevalent out there, we're finally starting to see the final piece of the puzzle, which are workers coming back in. We're seeing increase in labor force and labor force participation as some of these workers who are discouraged by the lack of opportunities and the lack of wage growth are starting to return. And given that this has always been a big part of Oregon's comparative advantage, it's encouraging to see. So we hope that these trends are going to won't just be a blip and will translate into the same sort of indicators at the U.S. level as well in the couple of coming months. And I think there's a good chance that happens.
And as Mark said, you know, even though the jobs are coming back, the unemployment rate's down below 7%. The U.S. level is closer to 5.5%. We're getting somewhere near what a lot of economists would say would be the natural rate of unemployment or the non-inflationary rate of accelerating unemployment. Some technical terms, but talk about full employment. You know, how tight does the labor market get before inflationary pressures start to build? A lot of that is starting to go away based on the headline unemployment rate. However, as Mark said, we have a lot of other indicators in the economy economy, that there's still slack, that things aren't healthy. Even though the trajectory has improved to such a degree that we think we're going to get there in the next couple of years, we're still not there today. And this, what you see in front of you, is a new measure called the total employment gap, which looks at not only cyclical unemployment, the people that can't find a job because it's a bad economy, but also looks at the participation gap, the labor force participation rate, the number of people that have given up looking for work due to the lackluster economy in the last 5-7 years, and then also those that are involuntary part-time workers. They want to find a full-time job, but they can't do it, again, due to a still weak economy in some sectors or some regions of the state. And you add all these things together, you get a more complete picture of the total Oregon economy, and we're somewhere around halfway back to where we were. Even though jobs are all the way back to pre-recession levels, the population growth has continued throughout the last decade, and we're more along the lines of halfway back to reaching sort of full employment in the state, where everyone sort of feels good about their job situation, their wage gains, and things like that. The biggest component here is the participation gap, and if we move to the next slide, we'll see the labor force participation rate has been down considerably over the last decade. A lot of people like to talk about the labor force participation rate, and it's both a very important measure of the economy, but also commonly misused or misunderstood, I think, in the sense that there's a lot of demographics weighing on this measure. You can see the gray line there sort of fixed the participation rates by different age groups at their rate in 2000, which by all accounts, 2000 was the peak of the U.S. labor market. You know, the economy never really been stronger at that point. So even if we fix it at this really tight labor market, really good economy, and then we just let the population age over time as the baby boomers move into their late working years and now starting to move into their retirement years, what would the labor force participation rate itself do just due to the aging of the population? That's what you get with the gray line. And so, you know, just saying that the labor force participation rate's down considerably in the last decade is a little bit misguided in the sense that it's really the gap there between the red line and the gray line that matters for the labor market slack. And that's what you saw in the previous graph with the participation rate gap, is the difference there. And we're starting to make progress on that. As Mark said, not only is the labor force coming back in aggregate number, more Oregonians are looking for work, the share of the population that's looking has increased throughout 2014 as well. And we're expecting to get another percentage points of gains over the next couple of years as well, as the economy continues to improve. And then additionally, you know, the regional performance of the economy does vary. Mark led off with some conversation about whether we think we can take another step up in growth, whether things will improve even further than what we've seen. But if you look across the state, here geographically, the growth rates we're seeing today are on par or if not better than the housing boom rates for much of the area. We're not back to the tech boom growth rates. We're not back to the early 80s cyclical recovery rates. You can see that the 80s were quite strong. Part of that just had to do with the nature of the business cycle, with a big cyclical rebound in the goods producing industries or manufacturing industries. You can see it most pronounced in, say, Eugene, Medford, and then Southern Oregon on the rural side of the graph. A lot of that had to do with the wood products coming back in the 80s following the really deep bust from 1979 to 1982. We got a big cyclical rebound like we used to in the economy. However, that's a little unfair. The economy doesn't really work that way anymore. The last three recoveries have been so-called jobless recoveries. So, you know, to get back to those sort of growth rates is a little bit, you know, it's going to be quite challenging to get to given the demographics and the nature of the economy today. However, across the regions, the growth rates today actually aren't that bad relative to the recent history of Oregon. And so the question is, can we take another step up? Given that Bend and Salem are growing as fast as they ever have, we could get a little bit more growth out of Eugene and Medford. Some of the rural areas combined are growing, you know, 1.5% job growth, whereas maybe they should grow 2% based on the previous decade. We're looking more at Portland as going to be the engine of growth if Oregon's numbers are going to accelerate statewide. Portland's growing as fast as they did during the housing boom today, but if we're going to see the statewide numbers accelerate, we really need a big engine, a big region of the state such as that to pick up, considering the growth rates elsewhere across the state.
And what could do that in Portland and raise the tide? Well, probably migration. You know, there are really two big things behind Oregon's growth advantage during expansions. One is our exposure to resource industries and manufacturers and producers of goods. And as you saw in the regional picture, you know, back in the day when we had even more of them, that was even more pronounced in terms of our, you know, growth advantage. Manufacturers are very boom-bust oriented. They have a very strong cycle, and that's reflected, you know, in our economy, given how much we're exposed to this. But the other big one, of course, is migration, that we pull folks in, young working age skilled households into our major metropolitan areas and older, wealthier retirees in more of our rural areas. And this really has given us a lot of our growth advantage over time. But unfortunately, you know, it won't last for forever. A month or two ago in the Business Journal, there was some Outlook article where they were polling Oregon economists and asking them, you know, about this growth advantage and how long the growth advantage would last. And they were all saying, oh, well, Oregon always has a growth advantage in during expansions, but we have no idea how long it will last. And that's I was disappointed because it's pretty clear, you know, when you look at the population cohorts, it's pretty clear. You see here on the right-hand side these big bulges in population, the baby boomers and then their children, the millennials. And given that we gain so much from these folks moving to Oregon, particularly the young working age households who bring their demand for housing and automobiles and furniture, and they, you know, set their roots and have their kids, you know, this is a huge growth advantage. Now, unfortunately, you know, over the next 10 years, the peak of the millennial population right now is about 26, I believe. Is it?
Or nationally, it's 23. Oregon's 23. A little older, yeah.
26 or something like that in Oregon, something like that. So at any rate, we got about 10 more years before, you know, this growth advantage. Not that Oregon will grow slower than the typical state, but that this growth advantage will erode somewhat over time. But in general, in Oregon and everywhere else in the country, the demographics are going to be a weight on economic growth. And this is a big part of our longer-term forecast. Over the next 2 or 3 years, it's certainly the case that things could come out a lot better than we think, that we could have a good old-fashioned, strong Oregon cycle in the next couple, 3 years. But over the long haul, or the at least the medium term, you know, I feel real strongly that it's going to be hard to offset the headwinds that the aging population are going to create. That's the graph on the left where we're looking at the change in the prime working age population, folks between 25 and 64 years old. And you see a couple years ago, a switch was flipped as the baby boom population cohort are entering their retirement years. And as we lose these folks, it's putting a tremendous amount of weight on economic growth. Not only does it lower the labor force, but these aren't just normal workers. These are extremely productive workers with a lifetime of experience. And it's not a simple matter to replace them with folks in say the millennial population cohort. And even the folks that you, when you do replace it, those new workers are coming in typically at lower wages and the like. And so this is going to put downward pressure on growth over the long haul. So looking forward, we just don't see the same sort of rates of growth that we've seen in past expansions. Here, the red lines show you the average growth in past expansions. In the 60s and 70s, Oregon employment grew at 4, 5, 6% rates during expansions. There we had a lot of things going for us in terms of labor force dynamics. We had folks moving to the state, and in addition, we had more participation among women and minorities. And as those participation gains started to play out in the 80s and 90s, we saw growth slow to the 3-4% rates during expansions. But we were still bringing in a whole lot of folks from out of state. We were still getting a lot of population growth then. Well, now as we're heading, you know, further into the, you know, and the baby boom population is aging, we've lost this participation. We're still population growth has slowed some, plus the participation has flipped over, as we saw in the last graph. We're now, instead of seeing more people enter into the workforce, we're seeing more people go out in terms of the retirements and the leaving baby boomers. So the upshot of our outlook is the same as it has been, that we expect the economy to grow, but it's going to be hard work to match the pace that we've become accustomed to in past economic expansions. So what does that mean for the bottom line or revenue outlook? Well, the revenue outlook has become a little bit more optimistic going forward. As we've built in this additional economic growth, this has improved the outlook in future biennia. But it is also generated in our baseline forecast a personal income tax kicker, which reduces resources in 15-17 that the legislature is working on now. The economic growth can go a long way toward preventing that kicker from being a revenue reduction, but it does. The kicker law does certainly put a roof on what we can get absence of any legislative action. So where did it come from? This change in our revenue outlook. Well, that, for the current 13-15 biennium, which is generating this kicker payment, the job growth and new jobs don't really matter. You know, even though we've had some healthy job gains at the end of the year and healthy withholding, that's not what moves the needle at this point in the biennium, because we only have 4 or 5 months left for these jobs to pay taxes, and in terms of most of the taxes that are getting paid this April, that's based on what happened in 2014, and so a lot of that, as I said before, is baked in the cake. So what we're waiting on here is really what's going to happen when folks start paying their taxes right now and through the peak filing season in April and May. And early indications is that that's going to be pretty big. Here you see the tracking of our personal income tax revenues are now growing at 10% year over year after a record December. That December set us to the point where we're almost $70 million ahead of personal income tax forecast for the fourth quarter. And so that $70 million of tracking is largely what has pushed us into the kicker territory, which is shown on this chart, which I bring up every quarter for you all, which shows how we've evolved over time. These are the forecast for the current biennium over time. The first one used for policy purposes was in the middle there. December 12 was the governor's recommended budget, was based on that one. The May 13 again was the close of session forecast where we locked it in, and since then we've become increasingly optimistic about the current biennium's prospects. The current, given our revision upward, the current forecast puts us $59 million above the kicker threshold. So that translates with the kicker into a $349 million kicker check to be returned as a credit on 2015 taxes. You'll see here as well that this dark section of the line relates to this personal income tax kicker base revenues that were generated by the special session of the legislature. As I discussed a little bit in the orientation, the Oregon law for us in terms of the balanced budget and the kicker are all based on this concept of the close of session forecast, where we lock in this number after the odd year session and set the bar then. Unfortunately, our kicker law is silent on any law changes that would happen after that, before the end of the biennium. And as a result, any revenue changes that are made by policymakers get folded into the kicker base. And that's what you see here with the dark line, that the special session raised $87 million worth of kicker base revenue. There's also increases in corporate and whatnot, but in terms of the kicker base here, we increased by $87 million. In absence of that, we would still be below the kicker threshold. And so given legislative intent, there may be some interest in unwinding some of this, but nevertheless, I will show in the future, it's not really fair to blame policymakers. I would love to, given that this was our mistake, generates the kicker, but it's hard to. No one factor of $87 million can really do this, and I'll go into a little bit more detail on why that's the case going forward. But first, a little primer about how the kicker works, since it has been almost a decade.
That's right. Since we're in the kicker territory now, just a quick refresher on what exactly it is and how it's calculated. What you see here is a very highly stylized example of it, in the sense where the first bar shows you how, our May forecast, the close of session forecast, folds in the legislative changes from the odd year legislative session that brings you up to 100%. The kicker threshold is 2% above that. If you take your example of our forecast now, where we're breached that threshold, it's not we return everything above the close of session forecast. It's not above the 2% threshold. It includes that 2% in what is returned to taxpayers in the credit on the following year's tax returns. And then, so that the distinction there that it includes the 2% that is returned is sometimes not commonly understood, at least when you talk about it. Out there. So that, just a refresher on where the kicker calculation is.
So the next goofy slide here, the camel slide, is meant to illustrate a couple of things. I apologize. It's the first is that, 1-2% is a pretty small number and that there's still some uncertainty going on. And like I said, I would like to blame this on the legislature. As you see here, without the legislative action, we'd be below the kicker threshold. But it's true, without a lot of things, we'd be below the kicker threshold. When you're up to 1% is small. So an example I was reading, it's in foodborne illness. I don't remember the exact example, but say salmonella or E. coli or whatever goes up by 1%. Over a time span, say that's 10,000 new cases of this, of whatever this is on net. You could probably say, in absence of the cases related to spinach, foodborne illness would have gone down. Or in absence of the cases related to chicken, salmonella would have gone down. Or in absence of eggs, you could probably take any of the big, carriers of this, or whatever you would call them, the food products that, may cause exposure to these foodborne illnesses, and you could blame it on any one of them because we're so close to the cusp. And that's what's happening here. Over the past year, I've seen articles in the paper that say we're going to get a kicker because of the legislative session. I've seen we're going to get a kicker because of tech mergers we've seen in Portland, or we're going to get a kicker because of charitable giving, for the Cancer Institute, or we're going to get a kicker because someone's going to win the Powerball here like they do every 10 years, or we're going to get a kicker because marijuana is legalized. That was before it went to the other funds rather than the general fund. But there have been a whole string of these, over the past year because we're so close of, an individual kicking us in. And that just isn't the case. Over this biennium, every month we have several surprises that are in the tens of millions of dollars on the upside and the downside. We see court settlements and rulings that change our outlook. We see changes in terms of federal tax law or federal benefits, that feed through the state system, where, issues with processing, folks going to electronic filing rather than paper filing and things like that. All these things make a lot bigger splash than typically what we're getting, we're getting blamed for, bonuses, I guess, at our big companies, deaths of our wealthy Oregonians. There's a lot of randomness here, and the numbers are just so big that we can't blame anyone, even the legislature, for the issues. The other thing I wanted to point here.
Trying really hard.
The other point is that we still don't know. Like I say, we think right now, given this baseline outlook, it's the most likely outlook that the upside and downside risks are as equally balanced as we can make them. But that means we're not sure if there is still going to be a kicker. As you see here, we still have $4.3 billion expected to flow in between now and the end of the session because we still have a tax season yet to come in. And so out of $4.3 billion, this $59 million above the threshold is still peanuts. And so we're still open to not necessarily having one in the May forecast. We'll just see how this tax season plays out. The other thing to note is that with the growth assumptions, when we're expecting more economic growth, while it can't reverse the kicker or create more revenue, it certainly can help mitigate the impact on available resources for the legislature. And I tried to do a little bit of the accounting here. You'll get a better budget box from both the Legislative Fiscal Office and the CFO's office here over, in the coming days. But in terms of the 15-17 resources, even though we will expect to release $349 million worth of kicker credits on taxes, our net change is I say only $21 million. $21 million is a lot of money, but it's much, much more muted than the full $349. And why is that? Well, there are a couple of big reasons. One is we start off at a bigger point. Here you see we start with the beginning balance. What generated the kicker in the 13-15 biennium was unanticipated revenues that came in. Well, the legislature has not to date appropriated those revenues. So to the extent that those aren't spent in the current biennium, that those can be pushed forward and help next biennium in terms of building the budget, depending on the legislative actions. The second big gain is just the economic growth, and that's helping across the board. We have $182 million more expected in personal income growth because of our improved job outlook. We have $23 million in terms of corporate outlook, increased corporate revenue, and $15 million here you see in terms of lottery changes. So a stronger economy in 2015 goes a long way to pulling that out. And the final thing to mention is, given the new nature of the kicker, we're not going to realize its entire impact all in the next biennium. Some of it will be spread into future bienniums. The 20 or biennia, or I'm not sure which, but at any rate, in 2011, the legislature changed the nature of how kicker payments are made. Instead of getting a check around Christmas time, it's more cost effective to fold it into the traditional income tax paying process. And so now kickers in the future are going to be like they were when it was first instituted, paid back as a credit. So either bigger refunds going out to taxpayers who are owed refunds, or smaller payments due for taxpayers who owe at the end of the year. But as a result, not all of it's going to show up in 15-17 because the taxes take a long time to come in. 2-3 years down the line, you still have a lot of amended returns. We have audits and things, and doing the math here, there's still going to be about 7% of these revenues that are yet to come in when we in the middle of 2017. We'll still have 7% outstanding there that will flow in over the next couple of years. So that's the bullet on the right is how the kicker credits are going to be spread over the next three biennium if the timing of tax payments holds to form like it has in the past. So, leaning all on this April, if this is this April really is going to be the make or break for our kicker, and that has all to do with non-wage forms of income and investment types of income, and not the jobs. You know, in terms of the jobs, we've really already seen the withholding out of the paychecks. What's left are all of these fungible type of taxable personal income, things that taxpayers have discretion over when they can cash them in for tax purposes or not. And this is where, of course, the uncertainty always lies. Right now, our baseline forecast calls for a very big increase this year in taxable capital gains and investment income. There's some uncertainty there insofar as last year the taxes were held back significantly by the impact of federal legislation. In particular, taxpayers pulled a whole lot of income into 2012 in advance of the expiring Bush tax cuts. And so then in 2013, we had a hangover where, although we saw stock market and equity price gains, we actually had a reduction, in end year, for tax purposes, these sort of investment, sort of non-wage income. That hangover is in the model and expected to hold things down for a couple more years to come because there really was a purge of this stock of potentially taxable gains. But nevertheless, the increases in the equity markets and the prices of taxable assets have been remarkable. And our models really want to do what happened in the housing boom and do what happened in the tech boom and really see an improvement in these capital gains and this in taxable income. And so that's built in. We've dampened the model quite a bit to deal with the hangover after the Bush tax cuts and also to deal with the hangover after these two bulges you see that happened in the tech boom and the housing boom, where we really did purge a lot of our potential gains out of the system, and it's going to take years for those to build back. So we don't get back to the peak we saw of $10 billion in the housing boom, but we're looking at doubling the current $4 billion we're seeing now in terms of capital gains. And talking to our accountants, it seems like this is probably a prudent outlook to stick our neck out and see what's going on. The tea leaves suggest that it will be a big year. Typically this time of the year when we talk to our accountants, they can't tell us much because they're just now starting to get 1099s, and they really haven't prepared anything for their wealthy filers yet because they don't have all the information yet. They're going to do that, you know, close to April 15th as possible. But that said, this year they are getting indications of a lot of their clients coming to them and asking for ways to, you know, what could we do, particularly just before the end of 2014, what can we do to mitigate a tax bill? I think we're going to have a big one this year. And so one of the things we look at are these estimated tax payments that happen in January and December every year, because they're small. You see here $200 to $400 million is not big in terms of the overall payments that come in, but they can often be indicative that, you know, in terms of where they're moving and how that reflects some of these folks that are most aggressive in trying to manage their future tax bill. And as you see here, all except for the 2009 tax year, when final payments were as low as they could go already, we were down to $2 billion in capital gains, and so there really was nowhere to fall. This is followed very relatively closely, this signal to what end up finally coming in once the tax season is all said and done. This is very atheoretical, so it's very dangerous to take this sort of relationship and map it to the future. Our forecast of the 26% growth, we expect a really big April, 26% year over year. That's based on our models and not on these tea leaves, but it is consistent with what these tea leaves are saying. So with that, typically, this is our personal income tax forecast. Typically, I show this to show that there is very little difference between the red and blue lines, even though we're talking about $100, $200 million. Qualitatively, this isn't much of a difference in the forecast. This time, it actually has use beyond that, insofar as you can see the kicker being built into the 15-17 biennium here. Not as big as in the past and a little smoother than in the past, but you can see the bite that it's expected to take out of revenues going forward. One of the hardest things for us to forecast and our biggest errors over this biennium have been in estate taxes. It's not our biggest line item, but it's the one that's fooled us the most. And so I was going to have Josh make a couple comments on how this is going.
Fools me the most. Thanks for that one. Estate taxes is one of the ones where we have two really divergent long-run trend stories that are out there. One is a lot of people's estates are tied up in their physical estates and the home valuations and land prices and things like that. And by and large, they're certainly plummeted during the recession, but they're coming back strong now, and we're expecting them to increase moving forward, same with asset prices and stock prices and things like that. However, the other thing is we keep getting from our advisors is that tax planners and estate planners are really, really good at planning around these types of events moving forward. They've gotten a lot better in the last decade to plan for these, to minimize the tax implications, whether, you know, it's gifting or moving or all these sort of other things. And so we have asset prices continuing to rise up over the long term, and we have an aging population. We'll see a larger decrease in the natural gain of the population with more deaths moving forward. So that should increase estate taxes, but at the same time, they're really good about planning around it. And so we kind of have some modest growth built into this. It's been surprising to the upside in the last, say, 6 months or so. You can see here with the graph. However, it still is below close of session. Where we were 2 years ago, the revenue is still below that by a few million dollars, even though it's continuing to surprise on the upside in recent months, and it's one of the smaller line items that can move by $10 million and push the needle a little bit.
All right. For the other second largest chunk are corporate collections. Oh, I should have changed the title on this. It's dated. Josh didn't catch the reference. This is a commercial for audio tapes for those of you too young or whatnot to know. But the story is, looking at this graph, I bet everyone can identify about when the new IT processing system came online for the Department of Revenue for corporate taxes. Just about the point that this thing started going up, 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 and it has not stopped. If I put February in here, it would be even higher. Issue being, we know that there are problems with these numbers that are getting worked out. Over at the Department of Revenue, we have some real champions over there that are working hard with the vendor to try to give us more access to this data. The vendor really hasn't seen anyone like us in Oregon because we care so much about income taxes. It's 90% of our general fund. We have very, very, we're very needy in terms of our data requirements, and we really want access to the core data, which is scary for these folks because they have proprietary software, and they're in the business of processing these returns. That's their software is all about processing returns, not about aggregating them all for research purposes or allowing us to pick through for different legislative impacts of potential laws and whatnot. But from what I understand, we're really starting to make some traction with the vendors, and we hope that some of these data problems are going to go away in the near term. So what do we do right now? We're holding the course, as you see here. This is not a highly theoretical model that we're using to account for this in the outlook. What we've done is we've kept the same model that we had before, based on the data coming from the old system, and just with the changes in the economic outlook, corporate profits and the like, we've adjusted this forecast. But we've taken away some of this in the near term. In particular, we have doubled the corporate refunds. One of the things that's going on with the new system that we've become made aware of is that for review, the DOR holds some share of these returns to review, the ones that are supposed to go back out. Right now, for the corporate returns, they're holding 40% of them to check on some number that got flagged for some reason or another, most of which are benign, that the payment's correct, but there's some flag that was raised. So it used to be under the old system, we had 20%. So we've got people looking at twice as many, humans are looking at twice as many returns here to vet through this. We think, and the refunds are coming in about half the size they did in past years, so I'm thinking, that when all is said and done, we're reviewing about twice as many, and we're getting about half as many refunds, so we'll just pull those out. The timing here, of course, probably isn't right, but we try to pull that out in the future. There's also an issue of double counting on the payment side, but I don't think that's quite as big, but we'll find out. When the dust settles, hopefully in a couple of months, we'll have a better idea. Hopefully we'll get this, some of this growing pains aren't so bad in corporate because it's a small chunk. Next year at this time, when the personal income tax is going through a new system, please be patient with us. So the March forecast, again, here we have the $88 million extra in ending balances. Pretty much everything is positive. A good sign, for the future that everything, other than state court fees, there really weren't any big drags on the outlook for the current biennium. Oh, as you see here, in terms of our confidence intervals, those have shrunk a whole lot over the last few months as we get toward the end of the biennium. We've got a year and a half in. But still, we're looking at one standard deviation, or 65% confidence, is about 256, which is well below that kicker threshold again. So there's still, a very high, on nearly 50% probability that we could still avoid the kicker should things come in weak. So in terms of forecast changes, here you see the one thing doesn't look like the others, which is 15-17, where personal income taxes are being pulled down by this $329 for that kicker payment during that biennium. If not, you would reverse those bars and you see the impact of this near-term, longer, strong expansion we have, where we pick up personal income taxes, a lot of it coming out of the labor market. Here over the next two or three biennium, we get a nice boost of, you know, a couple hundred, 100 to 200 million. And that would have been the case for 2015-17 as well, if not for the offset of these kicker credits. 10-year forecast, as always, as we expect the economy to grow slower than we are accustomed to going forward, so too will general fund revenues, falling somewhere in the 10%-ish over a biennium range relative to previous expansions when we averaged, I think, 16% per biennium in growth. So a couple more quick comments before we go. We added a couple of slides on tax structure and volatility for our new Senate chair to be interested in. In particular, there's been a lot of reporting out there recently about a recent study by the Pew Center of the States, which was a 50 statewide tax volatility study, but very, very shallow, maybe not even an inch deep in terms of the content. So we wanted to talk about a little bit of the things. The upshot of that was that, well, Oregon doesn't really have a volatile revenue system, which just doesn't pass the sniff test for anyone who sat here, you know, on the committee. I envisioned Senator Morse, you know, at his breakfast table spitting out his opening. But it's not true, and there are a couple reasons for that, and I'll talk about the right-hand graph here and then pass it over to Josh. One of the things, as you see here in terms of revenue volatility, if you look at overall, using the same data that Pew did, if you look at overall revenue volatility, there are only a handful of states that are more volatile than Oregon, half of which are energy producers, Alaska, Wyoming, Louisiana, and the like, and there's even some mining in some of these others. Those, you know, go up and down with commodity prices. Commodity prices can be cut in half in any given year, and guess what happens to your state revenues if you're Alaska when, you know, oil prices get cut in half. So those are where the most volatility is. And there are a couple of others there. Retirement havens have been very volatile because, in a good way, because of the growth they've seen in the underlying economy, some of these retirement havens. And on the other side, Michigan, where we've seen a tremendous amount of volatility just because the economy has struggled so much that, you know, during the last couple of expansions that Michigan hasn't added any jobs. But other than that, you know, there's us. But what Pew does is, instead of looking at overall revenue volatility, they compare Oregon's volatility within its own personal income tax to other states' personal income tax, whether other states depend for 5% of their revenues on personal income tax or 10% of their revenues, whereas we get the majority of our revenues from this very volatile source. So while it's there are other reasons why we might even think our personal income tax is more volatile than others, but, and Josh will get into some of those technical reasons, but even if it is just the average state, which it might be because we don't have a lot of rich folks, we know that on a whole, the general fund is far more volatile than that in the typical state.
Sure. And along those same lines, you see the graph on the left. That's a general fund approximation using the same data set that Pew did. You know, not all cigarette and tobacco revenues are general fund. You know, the only share of them are. It's hard to parse that out by state. But if we throw in all these revenues that are usually general fund across the states, and certainly here in Oregon, we're more volatile than the typical state. Both the median and the average are basically the same here. So the red line doesn't really matter where you put that. But as Mark said, maybe our using the same data set, our personal income tax itself might not be that much more volatile than the typical income tax across the states. Our reliance on it is so high. You can see there on the scatter plot, guess who over there in green, that's us. No one comes close to our reliance on the personal income tax. And so that overall moves the volatility, plus our underlying economy is more volatile than the typical state. On the next slide, we just have one more thing on risk versus return when we talk about income taxes versus sales taxes. The graph on the left is all states combined, the U.S. total, as a share of personal income, how much tax revenue are they raising? This is not corrected for legislative changes, so that does impact these trend lines, but that's also at the same time part of the point here. Is you can see the stability that the general sales tax has relative to the income tax, which is very volatile. You see the two cycles of the tax boom and housing boom. At the same time, though, with an aging population, the tax base is eroding for both types of major tax instruments. Grandma not only has less income because her Social Security check and her IRA is smaller than what her salary was, she's also not buying a sofa, she's not buying a car. You know, maybe she's taking a continuing education course at the local community college, but you know, her big items are she's not doing that. And so you can see here that the sales tax seems to be eroding a little bit faster than the income tax nationwide.
Yeah, and they both will fall going forward, as Josh said, as this baby boom population cohort, you know, enters their senior years. Both the effectiveness of the personal income tax and general sales tax will erode. But the general sales tax started eroding first, and there's more issues there going on in terms of the shift to services. Most services in the typical state aren't taxed, and as more and more of our spending on consumption goes into services rather than these big ticket durable goods like cars and sofas and the like, they're losing the tax base. And the other thing that has happened is, you know, online sales. Although there's been some legislation that stopped that flow of bleeding, there still is some, you know, ability to avoid taxes by going to other jurisdictions. So it's a risk return. And you know, so I wanted to say that, well, certainly we're more volatile, but when we're thinking about tax reforms, we have to bear in mind that the personal income tax, while it's a wild ride, you know, has been pretty lucrative in the average year. So with that, we're out of time. I always end my talks with a plug for Josh's blog. If you like this kind of data stuff, he's very prolific. Couple of posts a week down there, and please visit. So with that, Senator Haas, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Josh has a blog. Thank you, gentlemen. I very much appreciate your care in pointing out the projected kicker is just that. It's projected. There's a lot of water to go under the bridge before we get there. And we will not hold it against you that if the kicker does kick, it was because you were wrong.
Thank you.
But to me, and I know how these things work, the takeaway out of this is that there's maybe a kicker out there, but the bigger story, to me at least, is that Oregon's economy is recovering, it is strong again, employment is up, and as we'll see in a few minutes, education revenues and the formula is up. So that's my takeaway. Do we have any questions for these economists here? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. And thank you very much. As always, one of our favorite hearings of the quarter. Back to the slide, As Good As It Gets, which I think is about the 15th page.
We'll get there.
Just to clarify, even with the strong job growth that we're experiencing, is this still indicating that the average annual employment growth in this recovery is the lowest among the last recovery since the 60s?
Yeah, Representative Davis, I haven't actually done the calculation. It looks like, you know, as we're improving this, we're getting pretty darn close to that housing boom, it's looking like now. But I don't think we quite get there. We're still just south of 3%. But on average, I'm not.
That is correct. Certainly over the expansion, it will be lower.
Okay. Thanks. Just wanted to clarify.
Senator Edwards.
Yeah. On, I can't remember if it was slide 10 or 11, you made a comment that we are halfway back to. Could you expand on that? Because I didn't catch everything that you said.
Okay, Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the total number of jobs in the state of Oregon is all the way back. It's never been higher. However, we know the distribution of that and the share of the population with jobs, you know, because the population continued to increase every year. Mm-hmm. If you sort of the feel-good nature of the economy and a full employment where everyone who wants a job has a job sort of thing, we're more like halfway back. Just due to the participation gap, there's still some unemployment. There's still the people that want a full-time job but can only find a part-time job. Some of those sort of other measures of the economy we know aren't all the way back, even though the total jobs are.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. So I actually had a question on slide 15 as well that was talking about the As Good As It Gets. You had said that in the 60s, a lot of the really big gains that we saw were because of women and minorities entering the workforce to demographics that hadn't been in the workforce again. So is it possible? I mean, how can we, I don't know who you create to enter the workforce to get those gains that you had back then. Is there any way to do that?
Yeah, Representative Vega Peterson, well, in terms
of... That was a joke.
Yeah,
we're helping. This group here is helping.
Participation among women and minorities has not, still doesn't match the white male counterparts, but it appears to have topped out, where these gains have stopped for many, many years. So it may have topped out, but there's still a lot of potential here. In particular, there are some very worrying considerations in terms of labor force participation, not just because old folks are retiring, but within age cohorts, folks are working less. And the very, very most troubling one are the youngest workers. Our youngest workers are participating in the labor force at, all-time low rates, which, of course, will have implications on their, entire career path. Going forward. So there is room, there is slack in terms of labor force participation in places where we certainly could benefit from boosting that up.
Senator Bartsugger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide 24,
thank you.
So you show, I don't see any correction for any downturn in the economy in the future.
Senator, that's a good question. Yeah, it's the nature of this these sort of forecasts. In terms of being the most accurate, it's better to take an average growth rate, averaging both the booms and the busts over time, than to try to time those booms and busts. Because if you get the timing wrong, then the errors really explode. If we decide, okay, we're going to put a recession in, in June of 2016, that better be when the recession actually starts. We know one's going to come, but it's all a question of timing it. So trying to come up with measures of the smallest error statistically, it's usually shooting with one of these trend forecasts, and that's the nature of pretty much all of our forecasts, unless we know of a certain event that's going to happen on a certain time, like every 10 years the federal government hires a bunch of census workers, so there's a blip for that. But in absence of something like that, it's the timing that's the devil, and, that we can't really get a hold of.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe three of slide nine is where we're going.
Okay. Thank you.
And I believe three of us have been here a decade, and I agree with the chair, and we're actually working elsewhere, which is why we have this general fund that shows the Swiss Alps and the Grand Canyon. And after a decade, we never see the Grand Canyon forecasted. So my question is back on slide nine. We're in a geopolitical market war on oil right now, which is not your problem, but you have to forecast it. The doctor and I have been talking about what is the risk, what risk do you see if the price of oil, which is a stimulus, of course, drives it down and we hit deflation. And then the flip side of that is when somebody realizes they can't get any more market share and the price of oil goes back up to an unrealistic $4 a gallon that none of us want to pay. What are the risks there? Because you normally have a sheet of saying these are the pros and the cons and these are the risks, and you don't do that anywhere.
Yeah, Senator Boquist. Yeah, there are risks. Upside and downside are still there. Downside risk, you're right. I really should have. I part of the orientation was to talk about how well we articulate these things, and then what did we say? Not a word. But at any rate, there are downside risks out there, big one being the global growth. Most economists are not very worried about this because the U.S. is so darn big and trade isn't the biggest part of our, direct linkages. But that said, the rest of the world isn't doing that well, and that's obviously a concern. But the energy prices are as well, and both with energy prices and deflation in general, the first thing to note is where's it coming from? When these things impact the economy is when they come from left field, when they're exogenous or whatnot. Because what you got, as soon as we saw this drop in oil prices, there were media reports that said, oh, geez, this is a terrible thing that oil prices went down, because remember, last time they were this low, it was during the Great Recession. Well, there's a reason for that. Nobody was buying oil during the Great Recession. So these demand-driven deflation is what people worry about when it's because of, the demand. When these things come from left field, it's good when it drops, and like you say, if it goes back up, this is a bad shock for the economy. But I think that's important to put in perspective, as well as this argument about energy production. Yes, energy production has been a very useful industry throughout the last couple 3 years, and I would not be happy to be living in a little mining town in North Dakota right now or in Texas, because some of them the outlook is very dark. But on that, lower energy expenditures, if they're able, energy prices, if they're able to hold for an extended period of time, are unequivocally a good thing for Oregon. Yes, we have people tied to commodity prices, particularly farmers, which get hurt. We also have some metal makers and machinery firms that are tied very much into the mining industries and the energy extraction industries that will be hurt badly. There are a lot of industries and regions in the state that will be hurt, but on a whole, while there are losers, every single household consumes energy products and every single business consumes energy products. And so on a whole, it's going to be a net positive should these lower prices, you know, be maintained over a, you know, longer period of time.
Good follow-up, Mr. Chair.
In your modeling, when does the should end? I know where I'm going here because we've had this discussion.
Yeah, this is tricky. We talked a lot about this with our economic advisors. There are really, we're somewhere in two bands. You have an outlook from our vendor and the Energy Information Association that has a pretty rapid bounce back over the next year or two. Now, where that tops out is where it disagrees. Our vendor says we get all the way back up to $100 a barrel, you know, right, real quickly. The Energy Information Association has that. They don't do as long a term of forecast, but it seems to top out around $70 a barrel is where we go back pretty quickly to 70 and then stop. Futures markets, in terms of what folks in the markets are betting on, is much less growth. That we have slow improvement to eventually get up to 70 or so, but not for 3-4 years down the road.
Just one quick final. So just to clarify, what we're really saying here is in the modeling and in the forecast, you've taken into account that happy days are going to be short term.
Yes, Senator Boquist. At least in the, I feel more about it. I don't think it'll get back all the way up to 100. I think it's been pretty clear, the supply response, that we, you know, at $70 a barrel, there is a whole lot of viable production technology. And I think we've learned that lesson. So I think it'd be hard to maintain 100, but I think it will rise rapidly, and that's what we have in the baseline forecast.
Representative Lindgren.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. This is my first revenue forecast as a representative, so I wanted to ask a clarifying question. I think I heard you say that because we are going to exceed the threshold for a kicker potentially, and we still have some months to determine if that happens, by $59 million, therefore we will have $329 million less than we otherwise would. And I think I heard you say that one of the reasons, a key reason why potentially we will come in over, is because people at the top end of the earnings spectrum have done really well and have gotten bonuses or capital gains. And I'm just amazed that could yield $329 million less in funding for the basic needs services, public education, human services, public safety, that, you know, benefit everyone, but, you know, heavily benefit people of more modest means, that we could potentially lose $329 million because we have exceeded by 59, or potentially we will, the benchmark. Did I get that right? That would be very troubling public policy.
Yes, Representative Lindgren, you did get that correct. And turning back to slide 19, this refresher, the devil is here is in between that 100% close of session forecast and that 2% threshold. That once you go over the 2%, you don't just lose the overage, you lose that $300 million is that 2%, is roughly $300 million, just under. And so you've got that. So that really is that's really where it hits the road here in terms of the kicker law. Not only are you putting a lid on what we can take in, but once you go over that, there's this discontinuity where you take away an extra 300, which is, you know, it typically isn't this disruptive. This particular biennium, we're so close, and we're right in that 2% window. We've been right in that sweet spot for so long that, you know, it makes for this, trauma.
Mr. Chair, may I ask one follow-up?
Follow-up.
So I think you also said you know, because of increases in other revenue sources, that puts us at an, if indeed it plays out this way, and we have several months and a lot of uncertainty to determine if it's going to go this direction, we end up at a net negative of $21 million. So it's not as much of a net hole, but the notion that we are going to be $329 million below what we could have been because of a public policy decision that provides this kicker, and that the public schools and basic safety net human services are going to suffer if it happens, is just, I think it should cause everyone in Oregon to really take pause and think about whether we can change this situation.
Representative,
well,
welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Well said. Well said. That's true.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and may I simply say that in response to Representative Leininger's comment that it pays to repeat that over and over again, and I appreciate the fact that she did. My question is on a different topic, back on slide 14, and I wanted to expand on this issue of demographics a little bit because I'm aware that the United States and Oregon are not the only places where there are demographic challenges. Most of Europe is declining in population. China, because of its one-child policy over the last several decades, is at least leveling out and probably declining in population over time. Russia, of course, is falling much faster in population because of its lack of births and so forth. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about what these changes that we're talking about have on the implications for our public policy. It occurs to me that what that really says to us is that every young person is even more precious than they were before to us from an economic point of view. We don't have anybody to waste. Everybody who can be educated can be moved out of a criminal lifestyle into a productive lifestyle. Everyone who can be prevented from becoming a drug addict or be helped out of that situation into a productive lifestyle is even more valuable than they might otherwise be in a situation where we had large population growth in that red bar or in the blue bar over there. Am I right about that? And does that suggest to you what our policies ought to be to keep Oregon growing and healthy in the future?
Representative, I strongly agree. To the extent that an aging workforce is the disease, these young working age households are the cure. And so it's absolutely clear, and that will be more and more important going forward. Now, the trick becomes a lot of our rural areas that are having trouble keeping their children, you know, and that aren't gaining people from other states like the Portland area is. And that's where we're going to have to get clever, and where, unfortunately, you know, economists haven't done a lot of work. We don't have data on wealth that like we do on current income, and as a result, we don't understand it very well. But what our rural, a lot of these areas that have the worst population trends in Oregon still do have a lot better population trends than other struggling manufacturing towns in the Midwest or the South or farm towns and the like, largely because we get retirees. And a lot of them have wealth from California and whatnot. And so the extent to which we can learn to leverage some of this, right now our tax systems are, you know, based on income tax, aren't really designed to extract from wealthy folks, and neither are our economic development policies. And so it's going to take some creative thought, but unlike areas in the other country that elsewhere in the country that really don't have anything to go for, I think it gives us hope and gives us somewhere to.
Can I follow up just very briefly? I'm really thinking about the other side rather than the income side. I know that sounds strange coming from the chair of the House Revenue Committee, but
especially this.
The reality is that is that if we do a good job in our educational endeavors, if we do a better job than we're doing in preparation for work, those kinds of things, that's probably the best amelioration for the demographic shifts that you're proposing here. Are they not?
Oh, absolutely, Representative. Sorry, I went the other direction. You're right. You know, we know that there are incredible returns to education, both at the individual and the societal level. It's great investment. It becomes even more lucrative, like you say, as this population shrinks and we become more and more dependent on fewer and fewer young folks. So educating each and every one of them, you know, is going to give you more payback. So
thank
agreed.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the chance to ask that question.
Josh, Mark, thank you for your thoroughness, and we will see you, if not sooner, May 14th. One of the results of a recovering economy is improved school revenue picture, and we're going to take a moment with Day to explain $134 million increase in formula. Day?
Chair Hass, members of the committee, and invited members of House Revenue Committee. For the record, this is Dave Back, Legislative Revenue Office. So I'm here today to update you on school local revenue. Given the state school fund, any additional local revenue means more money, more formula revenue. Distributable to school districts and education service districts. So if you go to the bottom of the table, so here, this is the bottom line. We're expecting, actually, for the biennium 15-17, $134.6 million more to formula revenue. So I have to explain why we get to that conclusion. So we update this forecast annually because most of the data that we observe, input data, are observed on an annual basis. So last forecast was put out in March last year and was used for budget preparation. At the time, the anticipated local revenue was $3.538 billion. And with addition of $134 million, it becomes $3.673 billion. So how do you come to this number? The preliminary data for 14-15 property tax. We thank Department of Revenue for giving us a early look at the preliminary data. For 14-15, school district and education service districts imposed taxes came in much higher than we forecast last year. So the forecast was 3.3%. The actuals, based on preliminary data, it's 5.1%. So there is a level shift in property tax base. And on top of that, for 15-17, we had to revise up our forecast. So in the last forecast, we assumed 3.3% growth. Now we're anticipating 5% for next year and 4.7% the following year. So there's a level shift, and there's compounding increase in growth rates. Altogether, we have substantial growth in property taxes. There are other elements in local revenue. is common school fund. Our forecast about the ending balance of 2014 was almost close to, very close to actual ending balance. So we didn't have to change much about common school fund forecast. But low inflation environment and a little lower productivity growth come into play in forecasting common school fund because basically inflation factors and underlying real interest rate proxied by productivity growth determine the asset market performance. So we had to adjust down a little bit on common school fund distribution forecast. But still, we had fantastic growth in ending balance in 12-13, and also we had about 5% growth in 14. So our common school fund is distributed based on three-year moving average. So for the next 2 years, we're going to have very good increase in common school fund. County school fund and state timber revenue. Actually, 2014 payment came in a little lower than our forecast, so we had to adjust down a little bit. There are some miscellaneous elements that come into play. Payment in lieu of property taxes. They're all rolled into state timber. So altogether, we have addition of $134.6 million for the 15-17 biennium. Now, Mark and Josh covered all this background information about current economic conditions and expected economic activity down the road. So 5% increase in property tax in school districts and education service districts seemed justified, followed by 4.7% in the following year. If you look at the past, we have the data on imposed property taxes on school districts and education service district from 98. If you look at the entire time span and average, the growth rate annually is about 4.6-4.7%. And after the recession, there's a pent-up demand on housing, and housing starts, and house price goes up, and all these play come into play in determining property tax rates.
Thank you, Dave. We're running short on time.
Yeah. So
that is good news for school fortunes and schools in general. But as we've seen in the Senate working on this issue of central assessment, our property tax system is a mess. It needs work. It can only be repaired in a major way by Oregon voters. That's something down the road that we need to have that discussion. So any questions for Day? Ms. Barz? Thank you, Day. Thank you, House members, for joining us. The Senate Finance and Revenue Committee is adjourned. Committee is adjourned.